I'm joined on the line by Director of Policy and Risk at the Central Bank. That's Gerry Cross. Good afternoon to you, Gerry.
Hi, Ciara. How are you?
I am good. Thank you very much. The Central Bank has implemented new insurance regulations this afternoon. We just heard at 12 o'clock there's going to be a ban on price walking in motor and home insurance. That will come into effect just on the 1st of July this year. New customer discounts are not affected. And for automatic renewals, there's better information and reminders to be provided to encourage switching. So first, explain to our listeners what price walking is.
Thanks, Ciara. Yeah, so what we did on the foot of we carry out annual assessments to see what are the risks that we should be concerned about and that we see arising. And what we identified was that we were seeing prices increasing in line with the length of time that a customer had been with an insurance company. And we thought, and customers thought, and we found this out from talking to a wide range of policyholders, that they should be decreasing. So we investigated that, and what we found was that, yes, in all of the complexity around how insurance companies were pricing for motor and house insurance, actually, pricing was increasing the longer you stayed with your insurance firm. There was, in fact, a loyalty penalty. So we did a lot of work to look at that. We examined a wide range of data. We spoke to a lot of consumers, and in the end we decided, look, this is unfair to customers. This is not what customers think they're getting from their insurers. And we issued a consultation paper last year suggesting that we were going to ban this practice of price walking, and that is now what we're doing from the 1st of July. No more price walking.
So does that mean when anybody goes to renew their home or motor insurance come the 2nd of July that they aren't to expect too much of an increase then, or an increase at all?
So one thing that we also found out in our engagement on this topic was that customers do very much value the ability to get new customer discounts. There's a lot of discounts and good value out there for new customers. So what we have said is, although you can't, as an insurance company, you can't increase what you're charging a customer just because they've been with you a long time, you can offer first-year discounts. So customers will be able still to shop around, still to switch their policy provision and get those benefits. But that can only happen for that first year. After that, there can be no increases just because you've been for a while with the same firm.
And noting automatic renewals here, the better information and reminders to be provided to encourage switching, are those reminders going to come from the Central Bank?
No, they will come from the insurance companies themselves. Now, again,
it is stipulated to the insurance companies that they have to note switching is possible for any customer of their business?
Exactly that, Ciara. So a month before there would be an automatic renewal, the policyholder has to be provided with information that says, look, this is coming up. It will automatically renew. You have the right to switch. And here are some of the other options that there are out there for switching. So it's really, we thought about, should we say, you know, to try and restrict more this sort of automatic renewal. We felt on balance, we were a bit nervous around, you know, allowing policyholders finding themselves not covered. So this is what we've landed on, which is the insurer has to say to you very clearly, in a month's time, your policy is going to automatically renew. And if you don't want that to happen, now is the time. And this is how, and very clearly set out how you can change and stop your policy from renewing.
Look, I don't need to tell anybody listening or yourself that the cost of living is increasing. You know, these new implementations that will come into effect on the 1st of July, will it see people with the average person with more money in their pocket at all?
So what we saw in our research here was that for motor insurance, if you'd been with your firm, and this is on average, of course, but if you'd been with your firm for 9 years, you were paying 14% more. That's 14% more. For home insurance, if you'd been with the firm 9 years, you were paying 32% more. And so we would expect to see that impact being reduced. But of course, the overall impact of that will be also be spread out in a way that it's very difficult to say exactly how. But to those policyholders who've been with their firm for a long time, they will see that level of saving on average.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That is the Director of Policy and Risk at the Central Bank, Gerry Cross. So they're implementing the new insurance regulations. So automatic renewals, there'll be better information and reminders to be provided by your insurance company to encourage switching. New customer discounts won't be affected by the new insurance regulations. The ban on price walking, as we heard, in motor and home insurance, that comes into effect on the 1st of July. So the Central Bank published the final report and public consultation on the review of differential pricing in the private motor and home insurance markets in July 2021, and that proposed the new regulations to address the findings in the areas of the pricing practices. And as we said, that was Gerry Cross there joining us.
Want to get in touch with your favourite show on KFM? Text or WhatsApp us now on 0833 97 97 97.
Now, one quarter, that is, of motorists have admitted to driving over the limit the morning after a night out. The Director in Road Safety, Driver Education and Research with the Road Safety Authority joins me now. That's Michael Rowland. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon, Karen.
Very worrying figures here. A lot of people may say, probably of the older generations, that once upon a time people used to drive from their local pub home, no matter how many drinks they had, that was common practice. But with everything we've learned, I guess, throughout my lifetime, 20 years or so, about drinking the morning after a night out, it is quite surprising. 25% of people admitting to driving over the limit.
Yes, it is. We were surprised by the amount of people who admitted it. It was part of a survey we did with drivers. But I think before we even focus on that, we should remember that most, and I think it's important to point this out, that most drivers are law-abiding and do everything they can to ensure that they obey the rules of the road, especially when it comes to drink driving. And I think it's important also that sometimes what you find is that people take the precautions the night before. They have the designated driver, they take a taxi, they go out and have a good night out, and they come home. But they may forget about it the following morning. And, you know, over the limit is over the limit, regardless of what time of the day it is. So I suppose this weekend is a good opportunity for us to remind people, especially of the morning after, and to take precautions, to plan accordingly. If they are out the night before and that they have to drive the next day, they may need to restrict their alcohol use or else put some alternative measures in place.
Yeah, it's the first St. Patrick's festivities, I guess, for 3 years coming up this weekend. We know we have the extra bank holiday. Some people are off the 17th, 18th, and then going into the weekend. This weekend is known for I guess people having drinks and having maybe a few too many at times. And looking at these stark facts here, one notes, Michael, 1 in 10 alcohol-related crashes happen the morning after. 10% of driving under the influence arrests took place between the hours of 7 a.m. and 12 p.m. And concern raised at 118% increase in road deaths in 2022. That is the most worrying out of the three.
Very much so. This year hasn't been a good year on our roads. We have 38 people killed so far this year. That's an increase of 20 more than this time last year. And we are very concerned. And if those figures were to continue, we could undo all the good work that the Irish public have done over the last 6-7 years in reducing deaths on our roads. So we are very concerned. We do know that alcohol plays, you know, a major factor in fatal collisions. And, most drivers, whilst they do obey the rules of the road, there are those that don't. And I suppose there is a high likelihood that if you are driving over the limit, that you can and will be caught. The guards have come out in support of the campaign this weekend and will be out in force on our roads at night time, but also in the morning after. Because, as I said earlier, you know, regardless of what time of day it is. If you're over the legal limit, you're over the legal limit and are driving impaired.
Michael, what would the Road Safety Authority say in terms of those, you know, you're mentioning who make the effort, you know, make sure that they're drinking under the legal limit, would say the night before, designated drivers. What about those that use breathalyzers?
Yeah, you know, I encourage people to take whatever precautions or whatever they wish to do in terms of...
But can they be trusted, Michael?
Well, what I would say is that, you know, drinking, even with one alcoholic drink in your system, impairs your driving. So, you know, there are a number and a range of machines out there that people may use. But our advice is, if you've been drinking, you shouldn't be driving, and that no machine that can measure your alcohol intake should be relied on. The advice is, and people know this, like our survey, people know that it is, you know, that 74% of the people that were surveyed agreed that one drink, one alcoholic drink, can impair their driving. So people know this. So it is important that people don't drink and drive.
So for the night, for the morning after, Michael, right? Somebody mm-hmm. has gone out and would say this Friday they need to drive on Saturday. They don't need to be gone by a certain time. What should they be relying on to ensure that they are okay to get back on the country's roads and be safe doing so?
Yeah, well, people need to realise that if there's still alcohol in their system, they shouldn't be driving. There is a rough, figure that's often used, that, you know, one standard drink per hour would rid the body of alcohol. But it depends. You cannot rely on that because people's physiology is different. People can be tired. That can impair the impact of alcohol on the night before. People may have had a lot to drink the night before.
Michael, so, I often wonder, especially after the past 2 years, and would say antigen tests, you know, we see, I think it was something like 19,000 positive antigen tests were recorded over the 3 days, Friday to Monday, in terms of positive cases of COVID-19. Drink driving in this country is an issue. It's an issue in many countries. I'm not just saying here, but we're focusing on Ireland, obviously. Should technology not catch up in terms of people who do decide to have drinks and then the next morning they do need to go somewhere and ensure that they're safe rather than these guidelines? Because nobody can say for definite if they followed, you know, the one unit per hour, it takes an hour for a unit of alcohol to go through your system. You're mentioning different people. You know that different people process alcohol differently, metabolism, tiredness, all the rest that you're mentioning there. So it's not going to be foolproof or foolproof for every single person who follows those steps, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. That is true. And again, whereas technology may have a part to play, we would be concerned that people would rely totally on technology to determine whether they're fit to drive or not the morning after. And that's why we say that, you know, regardless if you have alcohol in your system or if you're feeling the effects of alcohol, if you're fatigued, you shouldn't be driving. But more importantly, if I'm driving tomorrow morning, I need to restrict my alcohol intake the night before. And I think that's important, that, you know, if people, they have a responsibility to themselves and the others using the road, that if they're driving the morning after a night out, that they should restrict the number of drinks that they have the night before.
Okay, I appreciate your time this afternoon. That's Michael Rowland, Director in Road Safety, Driver Education and Research with the Road Safety Authority, to bring you some key findings from the Driver Attitude and Behaviour Survey. That's of 2021. Is 9% of motorists indicated they had consumed alcohol before driving in the past 12 months. God, that's very high. I'm really shocked by that. 34% of motorists had two or more drinks before doing so. One in four motorists, 26%, agree, this is in quotes, there were times when they may have been over the limit when driving the morning after a night out. One in four agree, again in quotes, it is acceptable to drive short distances in your local area after consuming one alcoholic drink. Just going with that, even when you're not consuming alcohol, you're most likely to crash close to home because you feel you're more relaxed, because you're more at ease with the area. You feel like you know everything. So I think that's the worst view or behaviour to have towards that. And then 48% of motorists admitted to travelling as a passenger in a car where they knew the driver had consumed alcohol. Again, that's quite a scary feeling, completely out of control, knowing that somebody is also out of control because they're under the influence. And 74% of people agree that one alcoholic drink can impair driving. Do you know what? With that said, I don't really think it matters in terms of agreeing. It's a fact, isn't it? That any amount of alcohol, one alcoholic drink can impair your thinking. So obviously it would impair your driving there. But very interesting from the Road Safety Authority. And if you look at the St. Patrick's period over the past 5 years, in 2017, there was 8 serious injuries in terms of road accidents during the 16th of March to the 18th. 2018, there was 1 fatality and 6 serious injuries, again, for the same dates of that year. Then 2019, there were 4 fatalities and 15 serious injuries. 2020, obviously the first year of the pandemic and parades around the country cancelled. 3 fatalities between the 16th of March and the 18th and 6 serious injuries. And then 2021, last year, 1 fatality and 8 serious injuries. Obviously we want 0 across the board for 2022. Can you remove oneself from the World Wide Web or the internet? Most people would say probably not, but hopefully my next guest will be able to give us a more conclusive answer. That is Professor Alan Smeaton. He's Professor of Computing at DCU. Good afternoon, Alan.
Good afternoon. Yeah.
So tell me, is it possible? Can I remove myself from the internet?
No, you can't. Effectively not. Not unless you've never been there in the first place. It's probably the best answer. So the majority of people who say that you probably can't remove yourself are most likely correct. And there's a lot of probablys and most likelys because it's not absolutely definitive. The 3 kinds of content that are on the internet about you, and the first content is probably, first type of content is probably the easiest, and that's the stuff you create yourself. So all your Facebook posts and your tweets and your Instagram posts, etc., you can, if you've got the time and the energy and the motivation and the stamina, you can get all of that stuff off the internet.
Okay.
But you really want to have to. In order to do that.
Okay, so when I was 13 years old, 12, 13, Bebo was the thing, right? Everybody was on Bebo. It was so cool. You set up your profile. Bebo is no longer a thing. Does that mean, would say, potentially, when I'm in my 30s, 40s, 50s, that I could go along and Google myself, you know, Kira on Bebo? Will I pop up? Will my info still be there? Like, where has that gone now? Explain that to us, because I think a lot of people don't understand.
The internet right now, right at this very second, is a snapshot of information which is online, and it changes constantly. And websites like Kildare FM front pages, for example, will change constantly as new news comes on, for example. If you just look at the Bebo website, or if you just look at Kildare FM website, then you'll see stuff as it is now, but you won't see it as it used to be, as it used to be in the past. So you can't look at yesterday's version of our last week's or last month's or last year's. There is, however, a facility on the internet called the archive.org, and they run a website called or a system called the Wayback Machine. And what that does is it takes a snapshot of the internet constantly, 24/7. It is taking snapshots or backups. So I would be sure that if you were to go to the Wayback Machine, Kira, and find your Bebo account, you could find that picture of you as a 13-year-old, you know, with the local hockey team or hurling team, camogie team, or whatever it might have been, published in the newsletter or whatever of the local club. So while the information may not be accessible right now, there's always the probability of finding it in the Wayback Machine if you know where to look.
You brought up a really good point in an article you've written here, the difference between deletion and deactivation. I know so many people, especially over the pandemic, that just said, I can't cope with, you know, social media anymore. I need to deactivate my account, or I need to delete it. Yeah. There is a big difference there, Alan. Just let us know the difference between the two.
Yeah, the huge difference. So suppose you want to clean up your online presence because, for example, you're going for a job interview and you want to remove all those old, you know, drunken tweets or drunken posts. You can go through them individually, one by one by one. And if you've got the stamina and the patience, you can get rid of them. Or if you couldn't be bothered doing it one by one, you just want to say, I want to get off Facebook, I want to get off Snapchat or Bebo, as it was, or Twitter, whatever. In that case, you can delete yourself from that social media, or you can suspend yourself, or suspend is deactivate. And deactivate is like, it's like going offline. It's like freezing it. It's still there for you if you want to go back, but it's not available to others. You're frozen. You're in suspended animation. Deletion is the nuclear option, if you like. Deletion is basically delete me forever and never let me come back. So there's a huge difference between deletion, which is delete me forever and never let me come back, and deactivation, which is suspend me. And I suspect that many people in the, you know, during those dark times in over the recent years, what they really wanted to do was to suspend and to deactivate, but to come back at a subsequent time in the future. And that's the big difference between the two.
Now, even if you do decide to delete your accounts, it doesn't mean that you're gone from the internet. You note Google account, so Gmail, for example, or when you watch YouTube videos, they're taking your information. Google Maps, something I use a lot, or any of the Google services. And deleting your Google account would remove all of your settings you've noted here, preferences, purchases, and all your favourited sites. But then there's the part you can't see, the cookies that we've heard of in the past 10 years. So go into that a little more for us, Alan.
So they're like your footprints. They're the places that you've been. They're the websites that you've looked at. They're the links that you've clicked. And you can't undo having been there. It's a bit like you can't unring a bell. And every time you go to a place, every time you go to a website, every time you, you know, your location is tracked on your phone or something like that, it creates another footprint, which goes into the footprints of the billions of other people who are browsing the internet. And from those billions of footprints, Google get targeted advertising, and so does Facebook. Now, you can remove that picture of you. You can remove yourself from social media, but you can't remove your footprints. And that's that category of information that you cannot undo. In principle, the law says that you can go back to a company like Google and say, remove me, remove all of my content, and by the way, remove all of my footprints. But they're anonymous footprints. They're literally like footprints in the sand. We don't know whose footprints they are. We just know that they are footprints. So it's exercising a right that you have by law to remove your footprints and your traces. But effectively, to you and me, it's going to make no difference.
I honestly feel like a headache coming on when I think about just possibly going back on my footprints on the internet all through the years. It's insane when you and look into about this Wayback Machine as well. You know the digital traces you're making, the footprints. Using, you're saying, internet services that don't track you is the best way to obviously avoid the footprints. But a lot of us will Google something, Alan, as you know yourself, and because we're so impatient, especially nowadays, you're just like, oh, I'll accept these cookies. Like, how possibly can you use internet services without them taking your info and tracking you?
You really want to be motivated for that not to happen. You really want to have you to be motivated to use these non-tracking systems. And as you say, most of us just say, okay, we'll accept the cookies. And we do this deal with those companies because we get Google for free. We get Facebook for free. We never have to put our hand in our pocket for it. What we pay with is we pay with our footprints and our data. And for the majority of people, that deal is fine. Okay, you can have my data. You can track where I've been in terms of the internet. You can see the pages I look at, but I'm still going to get Facebook for free. Would you pay for Facebook like the way you'd pay for Netflix or Amazon Prime? Would you pay, you know, a tenner a month, 15, 20, whatever, euro a month? Probably not, because we've become used to it being free and we accept this deal that we do with those companies that say, okay, don't charge me any real money. Use my data, take it, merge it with everybody else's data, and I will suffer, in inverted commas, the advertisements that you will send to me. That's not a bad deal, really.
I always like to ask people like you who are so knowledgeable in a certain area, what do you do yourself in terms of using the internet? Are you somebody that is so careful and you use certain services not to track yourself? You know, are you somebody who reads through the cookies or manages the cookies? Because again, you have to be very motivated and that's a lot of work.
Yeah. Sometimes I will look at those, you know, cookie, those clauses, and I give up halfway and I just say,
okay,
click the accept. But I'm like the majority of everybody else. I accept this deal that I do with Facebook and with Twitter and with Google and with all of the others. And I will not use these shielding or these non-tracking services as much as, you know, as much as I should. But it's, you know, it's perhaps a bad habit, but it's an acceptance of the reality and an acceptance of that deal.
that I know. We have with those companies.
I know. I'm so bad for it. Like, I'll look up something and I'll be like, oh, I need to know this right now, because that's what the headspace you're in. You know, Google has become a verb. Like, oh, let me Google that for you. I'll Google that for you. That wasn't a verb, you know, 20 years ago or whatever. And if it's not instant, even if, you know, our Wi-Fi goes down for 2 seconds, you're like, oh my God, my Wi-Fi is down. You can't hack any of it anymore.
Yeah.
So it's no surprise, I guess. These people know we've become addicted to it, and they bring in the cookies, etc. A couple of years down the line, it wasn't at first just like once upon a time YouTube didn't have advertisements. Now you can't watch a YouTube video even for about 5 seconds without having a 10 second ad before it. So basically the sum up of this is, realistically, you can't really delete yourself from the internet. You look at people from the census of what, 1916 or something, and their info is even on the internet.
Exactly. So your reason, you can partially delete and you can remove some of that perhaps cringingly or even offensive material that you may have in the past. You can pull through your stuff and tidy it up a little bit, but removing yourselves completely, it's really not going to happen.
It's so interesting to talk about this. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. That is Professor Alan Smeaton. He is Professor of Computing at DCU and gave us the answer there. A view of one leading anti-smoker campaigner says that Ireland should be following the lead of Britain, which looks poised to introduce the move that under 25s should be banned from buying cigarettes. Joining me to discuss this is Professor Luke Clancy. He's the Director General of Tobacco Free Research Institute of Ireland. Good afternoon, Professor Clancy.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
Thank you very much for joining me. In terms of under 25s being banned from purchasing cigarettes, do you think this is something that should happen?
The thing about it is that, as you know well, smoking's been a terrible problem all over the world. And even now in Ireland, with rates have fallen dramatically, but they're still something like 6,000 deaths a year related to tobacco. And when you consider that the COVID crisis that we've just all suspended life for practically, something like 4,500 died in a year. So this is a huge problem that we've kind of come to accept, and putting on the long finger, let's do something about it. The things that we did do, the interventions that we know worked, like putting up the price of cigarettes and banning advertising, having smoke-free plain packaging, these are all helpful. And one of the other things that matters, particularly to young people, is access. And that's the way, one way of restricting that is to put an age on it. Now, it used to be, or it is, 18 at present. And the thing about that is that we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot, because say, oh, I'll be grown up, I'll be more than 18, it will be okay for me to smoke. So that's kind of one of the downsides of that. But does it work? We believe that it does. For instance, our recent research on young people showed that if there was a perception even that it was hard to get cigarettes or indeed e-cigarettes, then they were much less likely to use them. Twice as less likely. So that's fairly important, and therefore putting up the age matters. Now, the other side of that, of course, is that we know that young people get cigarettes even as it is under 18, and making some higher age isn't going to change all that. But it will change it for most people. Obviously, there are ways around. You get friends to get them. Some shopkeepers are irresponsible and sell them to children. And there's online. So there's all of that. But nevertheless, if there is a rule that you can't buy them, then that affects most young people. And that's a good thing.
If the UK does bring in a rule or a move like this, obviously yourselves at the Tobacco Free Research Institute of Ireland will be closely following this. But with what the information that is there at the moment, Britain, I'm assuming, and some of the professionals and those very knowledgeable in the area feel that this could make a difference. Otherwise, they wouldn't be bringing something like this in.
They feel it makes a difference. But we know that access makes a difference, I was saying. But honestly, we don't know that 19 will be different from 18. But the way they discuss it is that, well, what should be the age? For instance, in New Zealand, as you may know, they're going to ban the purchase of cigarettes for all people born after a certain year. You know, say it was 2000. Nobody born after 2000 could buy a cigarette.
Yes, I understand. Okay.
Forever. So they could be 40 or 50 or 60. Now, that sounds all right, except you'd have two kinds of society running. So it's hard to get it right, but it does mean that access is a big thing. You know, if cigarettes were to come on the market today, they wouldn't be allowed. You know, any consumer product that kills half of the people who use it as instructed would just not be allowed. But the reality is that they do exist, and banning them outright is difficult and may or may not work, because a lot of people are addicted and you just don't cut off their supply like that. So it's been a gradual process, and this is one other way. But nobody should think that if we did that, then we'd have no problem about smoking. That wouldn't be the way it is. But would it contribute? Probably yes.
What about for a huge majority of the younger generation who do decide to smoke? They've kind of turned now towards vaping. Cigarettes, obviously, massive problem. We know that for many years. We know when the smoking ban came in, it did, you know, make a difference for people. You know, secondhand smoke. I remember being in school learning about that, you know, having the jar of tar in your classroom and showing how much would be in your lungs. Personally, I never got into smoking because I would always think about that jar. So it is very effective. But the vaping doesn't have the same, I guess, model behind it in terms of educating people what it can do to their bodies. And there are a huge number of people in their 20s and teens that do vape. How do we now deal with that problem, Professor Clancy?
Well, it's quite right, or quite definite, that they do use them. I mean, in our studies, again, 23% of 16-year-olds are current users of e-cigarettes. And 37% have ever used e-cigarettes. So that is a real big reality. Now, they're not the same as cigarettes. But what we did find is that young people who use e-cigarettes are twice as likely to smoke. So that's one side of it. The other is that nicotine, of course, itself is addictive. And what we do know is that nicotine has an effect on the brains of children, that it doesn't have on adults. So it has permanent changes, not huge, but definite measurable changes. So it is harmful in itself, but from my point of view, even more worrying is that it may lead to use of cigarettes. Now, it's often in the context of polysubstance use, you know, that they also may have smoked, but they may drink, they may use other drugs, so there's all of these things. But they seem to get over those, but an awful lot of young people who start smoking never stop and die because of it. So the worry is that they're harmful in themselves, but not greatly harmful, but that they lead to tobacco use as well.
When you put it at the beginning of the interview, you know, 4,500 or 4,500, I know I'm not precise with the numbers there, I should be. Obviously, one is too many in terms of COVID-19. People have died due to the virus. That was in a year. But you take smoking over, you know, how many, you know, decades now, 6,000 people die due to smoking. And that is also secondhand smoke. You look at things in the modern day, the smoking areas and the nightclubs. I have been there. They're very popular. Even if you're not a smoker, you head out to have chats. You head out to see what the story is. The effect is just, it's ongoing in so many ways in society. And it's so interesting seeing things like this. And Professor Clancy, if the UK are bringing that in, is there any definitive date on when that would begin?
For them, I think it's in 2 years' time. But Ireland is looking at changing the access year as well. And, you know, if it's 25, say, in the north, although that, I think that's just England at the moment, but if we're 25 in the north, then it should be reasonable that we go to sort of the same thing. But I think what the Irish have been planning was to put it up to 21, which may happen with the bill that's just going through the Oireachtas at the moment, the products 2019 bill, which was delayed because of COVID. Mm. And they may well put it up to 21 in that. But as I was saying, we make these mistakes. We think if we make one change that that'll solve everything. No, it won't. And I heard your last item about social media and so on.
Mm.
What's happening, we believe, with tobacco and with e-cigarettes is that young people are being targeted. You know, we can't see, the images aren't out on the billboards, on the buses, but nowadays people, young people are being targeted with social media so that they're getting images and they're getting competitions and every other way that it's being presented to them that we don't even see. And we're trying to do a study on that here, and there have been some studies done in America on it, where it's quite clear that the same sort of tactics that we use for cigarettes, in other words, that it's sexy, that it's appealing, that it's novel,
cool, yes,
you know, all of that is being delivered in focused advertising through social media to young people.
I could speak to you all afternoon, Professor Clancy. Unfortunately, I'm stuck for time. Thank you so much for joining me.
You're very welcome.
Obviously, Professor Luke Clancy is Director General of the Tobacco Free Research Institute of Ireland. And our text line here, Teresa, has gotten in touch saying, about time young people were treated as young adults instead of imbeciles. Those that choose to smoke and the ones that don't smoke is because they know how dangerous it is and not because they're in plain packaging, etc. Education, what is needed. Thank you very much for getting in touch this afternoon, Teresa, and for all of you listening. Of course, hopefully, I'll speak to you again tomorrow afternoon.